Okay, welcome, ladies and gentlemen. How good to see you all. My name's Tony Travers from the LSE, and I'm chairing this evening's event, which is called The Future of Britain in Europe. I choose to get that carefully, yep. One word out can sound say the wrong thing. Anyway, we're waiting for David Lidington, and we're trying to check him. So what we're going to do is to begin, and we will then allow him to take his place, assume he gets here, and then speak when he arrives. Anyway, let me introduce the panel from left to right. Simon Hicks is Professor of European and Comparative Politics. She's got a new, grander title than that recently, in fact, at the London School of Economics. Professor Anand Menon, I'm not going from left to right now, I'm leaving you out, Joe, sorry, I'll come back to that, is Director of the ESRC, that's the Economic and Social Research Council, the UK in a Changing Europe programme, and Professor of European Politics and Foreign Affairs at King's College London. And Baroness Jo Valentine is the Chief Executive of London First, which is, of course, a major business promotional and lobbying agency, and more than that, for the capital. So what we're going to do is Simon will speak first for about 7 minutes, no more, five would be better, more questions then, 5 minutes, and then if David turns up, David, if not Anand, then Joe. Simon.
Thank you, I'll probably easy to speak standing up, and I'll change my comments slightly given that I'm not responding to the Minister. What I'll talk about is I'll talk about two things. I'll talk about how I think the terms of the campaign are going to shape up in the coming months and year or so on both sides. And then I'll talk a bit about what I think the polls currently say and why actually I think we may vote to leave, which might come as a surprise to you given some of you who know my previous work on the EU. But in terms of how the debate is shaping up, it looks to me like the out campaign or the leave campaign have probably got the most creative and interesting and more powerful arguments at the moment, and several reasons for this. One, when it's about the economy, I think the real problem for the Remain campaign is the fact that the Eurozone economy is doing very badly, the economic crisis in Greece, and the longer that goes on, the harder it is to make a case that being part of this new market and being part of Europe is good for British business. And it's easier for the No campaign to make the case that if we leave the EU, actually we can start to trade freely with the rest of the world, particularly signing perhaps a free trade agreement with the United States, linking us to China and globalising markets and so on. In fact, when you look at UK trade integration with the rest of the EU, our trade with the other EU member states represents about 20% of our GDP, represents about 53% of our total imports and exports. In absolute terms, that's quite a lot, but in relative terms, compared to any other member state of the EU, that is actually very low. So it's quite a difficult case for the In campaign to make that it is so integral to our economy for us to remain part of the EU. We are so dependent on the single market. And the problem for the Yes campaign is to argue that, you know, if the No campaign says, do you not think Britain can stand on its own? Well, then, obviously, you're unpatriotic. If you don't think we're big enough to be able to stand on our own globalising market, then clearly you don't stand up for Britain. And so it's very difficult for the In campaign to win that type of argument, particularly when the economic case of the single market is not a strong one, when the single market is not growing because of the Eurozone crisis. The second key argument is about, of course, immigration. And again, with the migration crisis, and the longer the migration crisis goes on, the harder it's going to be for the Remain campaign to win that sort of argument. And this, I think, is very important for the timing of the referendum, because if the referendum is a year from now, in autumn next year, then we will have another migration crisis. We always have a migration crisis in August and September. Why? Because the Mediterranean is flat in August and September. It's not rocket science. People try and move around because it's benign weather. The migration crisis will go away over the winter and will come back again next summer. And so you're trying to, if we have a referendum campaign in October next year, there will be people on boats and people being washed up on beaches and a new migration crisis in Europe. And the longer the migration crisis goes on, the harder it is for the Stay In campaign to try and make a positive case for the free movement of people. And the easier it is for the No campaign to say, if we leave the EU, we regain control of our borders. And in fact, the opinion polls show that the swing voters in the latest YouGov poll that had 51% leave or 52% leave, 50% stay in of the people who expressed an opinion, the swing voters there who say they weren't the don't knows in that poll, the one key issue they care about was immigration. They rated immigration as the single most important issue they cared about. Not the economy, not any other thing you might relate to Europe, Britain's power in sovereignty. The world, Britain's influence in the world, or sovereignty, or any of those types of. It was immigration. And if the immigration issue remains front and centre, the immigration issue is going to play into the hands of the Leave campaign. Right? So that's just the bigger picture. Now when you actually look at the polls and who these people are, this is where it's very difficult for, I think, Labour in particular. It's difficult for the Conservatives too, because Conservative voters are split. But it's actually very difficult for Labour, because the Labour Party itself, amongst its leadership, are quite pro-European, despite Corbyn. But actually, among its electorate, they're not as pro-European as you might think. So we had a similar panel, for example, last Monday at the Labour Party conference. And one of the things I take away from talking to some of the Labour MPs is what they're getting on the doorstep in the north of England, in cities like Stoke, in places like Chester, where they've got lower income voters in those areas saying, yes, we vote Labour, but we don't like immigrants and we don't like Europe. And they may lose those voters in a campaign if the Labour leadership comes out wholeheartedly in favour of campaigning to stay in. These voters could easily turn from Labour and go and support UKIP. In fact, the real worry and the real talk within the Labour Party is this referendum campaign for Labour could be like the referendum campaign in Scotland, in that they could lose a lot of lower income voters to UKIP because of this election campaign, in the same way they lost a lot of lower income voters in Scotland to the SNP. And this then could drive a wedge within the Labour Party in the north of England and a lot of northern cities. So the worry, of course, then is Labour then says we can't fight a campaign because we're too split amongst their electorate. So then they may not bother trying to fight a campaign. And then you get a different kind of concern, which is that a lot of Labour voters see this as Cameron's referendum. See this as a Conservative referendum, a London referendum. It's big business. It's the City of London. It's the London chattering classes telling us we should stay in. And if you're a voter in the north of England, in the public sector or a lower income job, you'd say, why should I go and vote? You may stay home. So even though you've got current polls look like they're neck and neck, what we know in studying previous referendums is don't knows in this situation often break 2-1 for the status quo, like they did in Scotland. But breaking 2-1 for the status quo would say, yes, we'd probably then go to vote to stay in. But you add to that potentially very low turnout, much lower turnout than in the Scottish referendum, and differential low turnout, meaning much lower turnout for the stay in side than the leave side. And if that happens, then it could be very, very close and we really could vote to leave.
Thank you, Simon.
Now, I'm very glad to introduce our keynote speaker, Right Honourable David Lidington, MP, who is the MP, or has been the MP for Aylesbury since 1982, and is, of course, crucially in this regard. 92, sorry, 92. No, yeah, sorry. It wasn't an election, was it? Not an election, it could have been a by-election, because I can't read my own writing. Yes, and is, of course, crucially the Minister for Europe, David.
Thanks very much indeed, Tony. I want to start by, in a sense, sort of bouncing off what Simon just said and asking the question, why is it that the Prime Minister believes so strongly that negotiating to secure continued membership of a reformed European Union is in our national interests? Because, it's true. I think that's as Simon has said. It's hard to argue that, you know, if we left it, we'd be in a sort of condition of absolute poverty. That's certainly not the case. But I think that what's in the Prime Minister's mind when he framed the Bloomberg speech in January 2013 was that we should be much more ambitious for our country than simply to survive. The United Kingdom is a European power with global interests. We cannot wish away the facts of geography and of history and of the need to establish a framework for cooperation and partnership with our immediate neighbours on the European continent. And we've seen, for example, one of the great successes of the European Union, one of the things which this party championed, has been the enlargement of the EU to embrace the countries of, first of all, Southern Europe and then of Central Europe as they threw off dictatorships and then communism. And I can recall the party conference in 1990, Margaret Thatcher standing on the platform with a succession of leaders from newly freed Central European countries coming in to shake her hand and say thank you to the United Kingdom and the Conservative Party for standing up for them at a very difficult time. And if we compare the experience of the last 25 years in that part of Europe with the experience of the 25 years after World War I, when so many new democracies were established, we see that the first time around, all of them, I think without exception, broke under either internal or external pressure. This time around, though there are still problems, you've actually got flourishing democracies and more prosperous countries. And I firmly believe that the key explanation for that is that, for all its faults, the European Union's accession process provided a mechanism by which to institutionalise the rule of law, democracy and human rights in parts of Europe where those things have been crushed for most of the 20th century. And in doing so, provided political stability in the central area of Europe, made those countries more resistant to subsequent pressure from Russia, and also gave us the means to address issues of corruption, drug trafficking, people trafficking, organised crime. And that motivation still affects the UK's stance in favour of enlargement to include the former Yugoslav republics, because on their own, without any institutional multinational framework, they are likely to be very prone still to organised crime and people traffic and drug traffic, and that strikes directly at our national interest. So there is a political element to this, which Mrs. T recognised during her time, as she did the economic element when she, in a slightly unusual partnership with Jacques Delors, really forged the single European market. And took a deliberate decision at the time of the Single European Act that, yes, this meant more majority voting, and that was unwelcome as a principle, but that the economic benefit to the United Kingdom as a whole outweighed that. And we've seen the fruits of the single market in the way which this country has reaped the lion's share of direct investment, foreign direct investment, into the whole of that European market. We still take about a quarter of all inward investment from outside Europe into the entire European single market area, far more than any other country. So there were reasons why previous Conservative leaders thought that membership, for all the flaws that there are in the EU, and after 5.5 years doing this job, I probably know those better than most, it was still worthwhile. But it needs to be reformed, partly because, as the Prime Minister said, the British public's consent to continued membership is wafer thin, but also because there are very serious challenges facing Europe as a whole. And what we are seeking are changes that, yes, make the British people feel more comfortable about their place in the European Union in the future, but which also address what are historic challenges facing Europe and threatening the prosperity and security of every European state. And let me just sketch those very, very briefly. First, economic. Europe is struggling to recover still from the crash of 2008. You look at the unemployment statistics for some southern European countries in particular, under 25s, more than half of them out of work in some countries. On top of that, Europe's also got to contend with a shift of global economic power to Asia and Latin America, with a United States that is enlarging its lead over Europe in terms of competitiveness as measured by new business formation, getting capital into SMEs, embracing the opportunities of 21st century technology, whereas often Europe's precautionary approach threatens to drive that all to America or China. And you also face the challenge of digital technology, which is starting to shake up white-collar and professional work in the way that automation did factory floor work a generation ago. And frankly, unless European countries get their act together and pretty quickly and raise their game on competitiveness quite dramatically, the next generation, whichever European country they come from, is not going to be able to afford the standard of living or the social protection or the public services that they expect today. And if that happens, then I fear we would be looking at political and social tensions which would dwarf anything we're seeing at the moment, at a further growth in support for likes of Front National or Sweden Democrats or Jobbik or Golden Dawn or Five Star Movement or any of the other populist or downright extremist movements that have grown up. And that sort of development in our near neighbours would be profoundly inimical to the interest of the United Kingdom, whether we are in or whether we are out of the European Union ourselves. So getting the economic challenge sorted, in my view, means deepening the single market further. It's a good market in goods. It's a woefully underdeveloped one in digital and in services, yet that is where most of the growth and the new jobs will come from in every European economy. It means driving forward with an agenda of free trade. We've done deals since David Cameron became Prime Minister with between the EU and Singapore, South Korea, Canada, now in outline with Vietnam. Huge prize is the transatlantic agreement with the United States, which I think would have geopolitical as well as straightforward economic significance. And we need to cut the burden of regulation and red tape on business throughout Europe, particularly on SMEs. And we are making progress there. And in fairness, the new commission, particularly thanks to Frans Timmermans, the Dutch commission who's number two, dropped 80 measures from the commission's agenda, is really acting on the principle Europe where necessary but national where possible. And that's a good thing, but we need to see that further turbocharged. Secondly, we've got to sort out the strategic challenge of a different integrationist dynamic at work in different parts of the EU. For as far ahead as I can see, there are going to be 19 or so member states that are part of the currency union, and 9 or so that are not, through choice or because they don't meet the entry criteria. And those who've chosen to join the euro, I think, are going to, they tell me, they are going to feel the need to integrate fiscal and economic policies more closely amongst themselves to ensure the stability of that currency union. And I think these sort of the events we've seen over Greece in the summer have reinforced that mood. They're not yet agreed on the method of doing it, but the need is something they all feel they share. But how do you do that while having safeguards for the integrity of a single market at 28, safeguards against caucusing by a eurozone that will have a built-in qualified majority should they choose to act in that way, safeguards for the integrity of decision-taking at 28 on non-eurozone issues, and for the duty of European institutions to look after the interests of all members and not just a subset of member states. So that's another element. Third element is an ever closer union comes out of that, because, you know, to describe that differential dynamic, different parts of the EU will want to integrate more closely than other parts, that ever closer union is not going to be right for every country. We need to have a clear arrangements that demonstrate the UK is not forced to go down some inevitable path to political union. Third, Europe has this challenge of how any society integrates large numbers of people and manages the wish of large numbers of people of different languages, cultures, backgrounds to come to them. Now, part of this is movement within the European Union, in particular the way in which, certainly under our system, people can often get access to benefits before they've contributed at all to the system. but also now very large numbers of people from outside Europe who are attracted by the messages they get on modern technology, that there is a better life available, who feel they can try their luck going between continents, not just to the next country, and with people traffickers who are not fly-by-nights. They are professional multinational businesses engaged in criminal enterprises who are exploiting them and shipping them into whichever developed country they hope they think provides the best route in at any one time. Now, actually, it's a separate, interesting argument that I think to actually deal with a challenge on that scale requires multinational cooperation. Actually, it seems to be foolish that we would just ignore the fact that there are processes for such cooperation within the current European structures. That there are European answers to this, and if you look at what David Cameron and Theresa May are advocating, I mean, they are amongst the leaders in putting forward ways in which we could address that challenge. But that's sort of a separate but very important subject. But we need to tackle that challenge of large numbers of people, the challenge that poses in terms of integration, pressure on public services. And then fourth and finally, people are disaffected with conventional politics in pretty well all the advanced democracies. And one element of that in this continent is people, not just in Britain, are disaffected with European decisions which they see as being remote and unaccountable. I mean, I don't believe there is such a thing as a European demos. And that's why European Parliament elections tend to be fought on the basis of 28 different national elections and how hard people in each country want to kick their government at the time. And why turnout in European elections still tends to be dismally low in most countries, well below the level at national parliamentary or presidential elections. And I think the lesson there is we need to have a stronger voice for national parliaments, building on the systems that are already there in embryo in the Lisbon Treaty, for parliaments to check and hold to account and push for reviews, and in some circumstances, I believe, to block commission initiatives. But also, I think, a more assertive voice for national governments through the mechanism of the European Council and the Council. And I think that's something that, you know, we need to get on and do, because I think the Commission has tilted too far towards the European Parliament in recent years. We've seen an imbalance in the institutional framework in Brussels. Now, I think that adds up to a pretty significant shift in the way that the European Union does business and would make it much more fit for the challenges of the century that we have now entered. And it's got to break free, if it's to survive, in my view, of a model that looks at things as they were in the 1950s and embraces the fact that Europe has to accept its own diversity and needs to reach out to the rest of the world and not to measure European unity by the height of the barriers that it erects in the face of the world outside. Get that sort of thing, I think that would be a real prize in terms of advancing and enhancing the national interest of the UK. And if you go back and read the Bloomberg speech, I think you will see that that is what David Cameron was arguing for, and that's what he's pursuing in the negotiations.
Thank you.
Thanks, David. Anna.
Thanks, Tony. As Simon said, we both spoke at the Labour Party conference last week, and actually, of all the things that surprised me, and there were many things that surprised me at the Labour conference last week, but of all the things that surprised me, we had a room of about 100 people, and I asked at the start, so who would vote to leave the European Union, and not a single hand went up, which took me aback a bit. And so I took it upon myself to give a Eurosceptic talk on that occasion, just to be difficult. Now, the fact of the matter is I agree with a lot of what David said, but just because I don't want you to sit through the same talk twice, what I'm going to try and do is take issue with what he said, just so we can have a debate about it. I'm going to start where he started, essentially, and try to come to a different conclusion. And my starting point is also Margaret Thatcher, and it's 1988 when she made her Bruges speech. Okay? Now, if you haven't read the Bruges speech, you should, because it's a superb speech. And it was also a massively prescient speech, because if you read that speech, she says three things. She says, this is what I want from Europe. I want a single market. I want enlargement to the east. There's a wonderful passage about the great capitals of Central and Eastern Europe. Yeah. And she says, and I want minimal foreign and defence policy cooperation, because we face in the world challenges that we should sometimes collaborate to confront. Okay. The irony of our debate in this country about our membership of the European Union is that Margaret Thatcher was the only leader of her generation in the European Union who got precisely what she wanted. Her key requisites in that speech were met to an extent, I would argue, that can't be said of either Chancellor Kohl or François Mitterrand. We came out of those debates of the late 1980s, early 1990s, as the triumphant European power. And one of the problems we have in Europe, I would argue, is not that Europe works against us, but we are essentially a status quo member state. We're a member state that pretty much is happy with where things are, and so we're a bit worried about things moving forward. Now, let me say a few things about that for those of you who are inherently sceptical about this. Firstly, the kind of shibboleth of social and employment over-regulated Europe. Certainly it's true to an extent, and it's true for a number of complicated reasons, but the most striking thing for me about social Europe since Jacques Delors turned up at the TUC and they sang Frère Jacques to him in 1988 is that his ambitions were never achieved. You had the social protocol. It was actually not that impressive at the time and has been watered down since because the European Union has decided since the mid to late 1990s we can't really regulate on social policy anymore. They use something called the open method of cooperation because they can't agree and they can't impose. And actually EU social policy is irksome for some businesses. I'm not denying that. But overall, if you look at the European Union, you could not, in all fairness, describe it as a socialist or social policy state because its regulations are minimal and they are weak. On this notion, the second note, I'm slightly fired. I went to a Bruges group meeting at lunchtime today, so I'm kind of arguing against people you might not have heard. But on the point about ever closer union, the other bugbear, which is that Europe is engaged on a path towards federalism, it absolutely isn't. It absolutely isn't, partly because a number of member states share our analysis. The Dutch aren't federalist anymore. The Scandinavians never were. So there's a block of member states that are pretty like-minded anyway. Besides which, even those member states that are federalists believe in federalism in different ways and could never agree on a single model, and it requires unanimity to move forward. So I think that sort of demon that unless we do something they will push ahead regardless can be disregarded. On foreign policy, this is another thing I hear. Britain's role in the world is stymied by our membership of the European Union. We fought a war in Iraq. We might not agree whether it was the right war or the wrong war. We fought a war against Iraq when the French and Germans, who were meant to dominate the European Union, didn't. We have a foreign policy. We are not constrained in the use of that foreign policy at all by the European Union, except in trade, which is an exception, I agree. But in normal foreign policy, we can act alone when we want. We can act with our allies when we want to, which strikes me, as indeed the balance of competences report that the government carried out argues exactly, that strikes me as a good deal. And actually, another way of looking at Britain's situation is to listen to what other Europeans say about us. Since the mid-1990s, my French friends have done nothing but moan about the liberal Anglo-Saxon single market we have imposed upon them. If you talk to an official from any other member state about who does Brussels negotiations best, you know what they will say. They will say the British. They are unparalleled in their ability to secure the outcomes they want. It's a tribute to David's Foreign Office, if you like. They are unparalleled in their ability to secure the outcomes they want from negotiations in Brussels. And actually, look at the EU agenda now. Digital single market, capital markets union, deregulation, scrapping things. And this is partly due to this government's initiative, absolutely. But to an extent, it also predates it. We're flogging a horse that's going the direction we want it to go in anyway, would be my argument. Now, lest this seems overly simplistic and one-sided, I'm not saying that every single thing in the European Union is rosy. And I think there are real threats to the British position on the horizon. I think in particular, the precise point that David made, if the Eurozone integrates further, that puts us in an invidious situation where we could be marginalised and outvoted by the Eurozone acting together. Nigel Lawson wrote it up very well in an article in the, was it the Times or the Telegraph?
Times.
But I think these concerns are, I've written down a word I've never managed to say in public successfully, precipitative. I think those concerns are precipitative. I'm quite proud of myself now. Because the Eurozone hasn't integrated yet. Everything's in the future tense about this. Wouldn't it make more sense to vote on this once they have? And actually, I don't think they will. I think they should. I think if you need to maintain the euro, those countries need to move further forward on economic and political integration, or we'll get this crisis all over again. But again, most of them aren't talking to each other at the moment, and the ones who are don't agree. So how you find the Eurozone member states in a position to unanimously agree on a treaty change that moves them in a direction they don't all agree on is beyond me. And I think that saves us. That's quite good from where we're concerned, except that it might lead to another Eurozone crash down the road, which obviously isn't so good. The fact of the matter is, there is a danger, but it lurks down the road. And at some point, we're going to have to confront that. But I do not think that moment is now. So in sum, I'd say the European Union isn't perfect. God only knows it has its flaws. But broadly, it's the kind of European Union we should want, because it's one that allows our businesses to trade across the whole of the continent. And that is why, from the same Margaret Thatcher base, I would slightly disagree with David.
Joe.
Okay. Tony told me I was speaking about 2 minutes ago. Am I allowed
did.
To admit
That's
that?
No, yeah, I think it's fair to say, yes. I think we need a business voice.
So I've been hauled in from where you're all sitting. But anyway, let me go for it. I'm Chief Executive of London First, which is a business membership organisation which seeks to make London the best city in the world in which to do business. So I'm coming from that perspective and what I'm about to say. Firstly, what's business's view on all this, this Europe stuff? Essentially, simplistically, there's a spectrum, which is large global international businesses are pro-staying in Europe. The other end of the spectrum is owner-managed domestic businesses. And obviously, those who export to Europe have more of an interest in staying in Europe. So the business interest in this largely divvies up that way. But from where our members in London sit, they are very, very largely pro-staying in Europe. I'll come on to the reform question. But Europe is the largest market in the world, I believe. We are a global trading nation and a very global trading city in London. We're possibly the most successful cosmopolitan business centre in the world. And so we see things in terms of our relationship with the rest of the world and what's not to like about having access to the largest market in the world. That global talent hub, which is what we see London as, there are three things that relate to that very strongly, all of which are deeply political at the moment. One is airports and air connectivity to the rest of the world. The other is Europe. And the third is migration. So a few things to sort out there. From where we sit, we see obviously the emerging economies growth in that space. South to south of the world trade. Huge increase in trade on that side of the world. So we are a bit part player. We may be a very effective bit part player, but we are a bit part player in this broader context in which we operate. We're very interested in Europe doing deals with the rest of the world. We think it's better on the whole to do it via Europe, where we have a strong influence in the way that they operate. But you'd have thought that an entity such as Europe would have a stronger negotiating position than a single entity. The other things, just on the things we're looking for from Europe, as has been touched on, we're a very strong service economy in London. We're a very strong technology centre. Therefore, there is upside in terms of the single market getting sorted out in those two dimensions. On migration, as far as I know, in migration from Europe has been a net economic benefit to the UK, and out migration, the opportunity to go and work in the rest of Europe is an opportunity for Britons. So I know I'm oversimplifying a massively complicated subject, but again, that's good. On the subject of reform, we regard Europe as a very imperfect construct. But we are, I'm not quite sure, instinctively pro this larger trade bloc. And therefore, we see the subject of reform as just a long game, of which we are just playing a little part of the game in the next few 18 months, although it obviously has this in-out bit at the end of it. But from our perspective, it's a long negotiation in which Britain should have a very powerful role. As a business organisation whose members are very largely pro-staying in Europe, we find it very difficult to speak at the moment. The Prime Minister is I don't know, we get mixed messages as to whether it's appropriate to say we want to stay in Europe at the moment. And on the other side of the equation, people are concerned about consumers. You know, the consumers of any business will be on both sides of this argument. And so it slightly feels as though we have both hands up behind our back at the moment in terms of saying that actually we want to get into Europe, negotiate and make it work. We're not the ones driving to come out. I'll just finish by saying that we're worried that this rather sort of rational invoice from our how it looks from our perspective is one that's a boring to listen. People won't want to listen to it from business, and we're going to come in too late because the no voice will be out there and ahead of us.